people, she scans the crowd. By the side of the boat, she spots a young mother with three children. Meilin steers Renshu towards them. Each child has a bag, and the mother holds a baby in her arms. The silky tufts of the baby's hair stick up like thick, wild grass. The children huddle near their mother. A boy, who could be about 5, and 2 girls, identical twins, maybe a bit older, with glossy plaits and padded jackets. They peek at Meilin and Renshu, then whisper to each other. Meilin catches the mother's eye and nods. The mother smiles back. The placid moment doesn't last long. The baby starts writhing in his mama's arms. Then he arches his back and kicks, pushing against her. The little boy is trying to get the twins to play, but they ignore him, so he pokes his ma, then pinches the baby. This sets the baby off into high-pitched shrieks. The boy pulls one of the twins' plaits hard. She slaps him across the face. The other twin tackles him, and the mother shouts at them all to stop it immediately. Now they are all crying, and the baby screams even louder. The second twin shoves her little brother, and he stumbles into Renshu. All along the deck, people shout and shove back. In the ruckus, a man who reeks of alcohol loses his balance and falls on his backside. More embarrassed than hurt, he staggers to his feet and starts shouting at the young mother. She is apologizing, the baby is howling, the kids are bickering, and the man is yammering at them in an unfamiliar dialect. Finally, the man says something in disgust and shoulders his way through the onlookers. "What a bastard," Meilin says to the mother. "Do you want a hand?" The woman's look of relief makes Meilin teary herself, and she takes the baby into her arms. Holding the squirmy bundle, she begins to sway, singing softly. This action soothes her own jangled nerves. The mother alternately scolds and comforts her other children until they, too, calm down. Meilin and the woman begin to chat. The young mother, named Zhao Peiwen, is from a small village near Wuhan. Her husband is in the army. He was able to procure boat tickets, but he didn't have enough influence or cash for a cabin in the hold. Still, they are grateful to escape. There will be temporary housing for them in Taiwan, and he'll join them here when he can. The baby has calmed. Peiwen takes him back, thanking Meilin again for her kindness. "And you?" she asks. "What is your story?" After sharing their names, Meilin says they got separated from their family after the war. Before she can continue, the conversation is interrupted by more commotion. Alarmed, Meilin and Peiwen strain to see what's happening. A military police officer and one of the crew members are checking tickets, working their way along the deck.
"There are too many passengers to travel safely. Priority is for military and military families. Those without proper identification must disembark," the officer intones.
"But I bought a ticket,"
a man protests.
"It doesn't matter if you can't show proper identification."
The officer signals to a colleague to escort the man away. Meilin lets out a slow breath, trying to contain her panic. The officer is getting closer. As he speaks with the passengers, people argue, waving papers and passports. More often than not, he shakes his head and they are pulled off the ship, dragged away. Someone worms through the crowd, trying to evade questioning, but this simply draws attention. Soon, another officer catches him on the other side of the deck. Meilin's heart is rabbiting. She has nothing. No gold, no jewellery, no cash. Should she and Renshu duck down and creep away?
"Papers,"
a male voice demands at her side. Meilin jumps. So intent on watching the first officer, she didn't notice this other one closer. She fumbles in her basket, reaching after papers that don't exist.
"Here."
Peiwen thrusts a bundle into his hands. Meilin stares at her in astonishment. While he checks the paper's validity, Peiwen shifts the baby from one hip to the other and makes the tiniest motion with her head, indicating that Meilin must stay silent. She grasps Mei Lin's hand to stop her frantic scrabbling in the basket. The man peers at Pei Wen and says her name. She nods. He looks at the next paper and says two more names, Zhu Huifang and Zhu Huiqing. She indicates her twins. Zhu Huifei. She nods at her boy. Finally, she holds up the baby when the man says, Zhu Huibao. He shuffles the pages, and Pei Wen gestures to Mei Lin and Ren Shu. He looks at Mei Lin and says, Zhu Yuming. She nods. Then, Deng Jinwei. Ren Shu takes his cue from Mei Lin and nods too. The man hands the papers back to Pei Wen and continues to the next person. What did you do? Mei Lin whispers. Pei Wen shushes her. Later, she whispers. Mei Lin watches the unlucky passengers being escorted off the boat. She shudders to think how close she and Ren Shu were to being among them. A long horn sounds. The boat finally begins to pull away. Passengers clutch their hats, scarves fly in the wind. People sob as they lose sight of family and friends on shore. The air is jumbled with dialects, but the cadence of disbelief and grief is recognisable in any language. Mei Lin turns to Pei Wen. Thank you. You saved us. How did you... Pei Wen cuts her off. We were supposed to meet my sister-in-law and her husband in Shanghai. We were going to travel to Taiwan together, but they didn't turn up. I couldn't risk waiting. We had to leave without them. Her voice falters as she wipes her eyes. There are no easy decisions in difficult times, Mei Lin murmurs. You needed two military travel permits. I had two to spare. That wasn't a difficult decision. Ren Shu is amusing Pei Wen's kids. He is showing them the finger bomb game Mei Lin remembers from Chongqing. He wraps his fingers around each other to form a tangled nest and dares the kids to lift his fingers one by one. They giggle with nervous relief each time the finger stands up and the remaining fingers remain quiet. If they can raise all his fingers except for the trigger, they win. But if they raise the wrong one, he shouts, Kaboom! Pei Wen picks up the conversation again. It's been just her and her children for months. She tells Mei Lin they were all born during the war. Each time her husband came home on leave, it was a great celebration. And then, of course, 9 months later, a baby. Happy to be distracted from her own thoughts, Mei Lin feels herself warming to Pei Wen. The boat navigates the Huangpu River, dodging carcasses of sunken ships and live mines still lurking in the riverbed. On either side, the banks are littered with the wreckage of burned-out buildings, tangled barbed wire, and rubble left from the decade-long struggle for control. Smoke rises off fires still smouldering from the latest skirmishes. This choked waterway is as different as can be from the swirling, treacherous waters of Sealing Gorge. But Mei Lin thinks to herself that this, too, is a passage through the gates of hell. At last, they reach the mouth of the river, and the boat moves into the sea. Vast open waters lie ahead. Mei Lin watches the shoreline recede. Where are you going once you get to Taiwan? Pei Wen asks. Mei Lin shies away from the question. She's not sure how to answer what she hasn't even asked herself. She's relieved when one of the girls comes over and says she's hungry. The other kids soon flock around her. After raising her eyebrows to ask if it's okay, Pei Wen hands Mei Lin the drowsy baby. Then she opens her bag and gives them each a red bean paste bun. She holds out the bag to Ren Shu and Mei Lin. The buns are one of Ren Shu's favourites. Mei Lin can't remember when they last ate. Her stomach rumbles, and she's sure his does too, but Mei Lin shakes her head. No, they have nothing to share in return. Go on, urges Pei Wen, holding the buns out closer to Ren Shu. You have helped us, please. Mei Lin relents and nods at Ren Shu. He takes one and thanks Pei Wen. Mei Lin says she's not hungry. Save them for the kids. And look, the baby is finally asleep. When Pei Wen takes the sleeping boy back in her arms, Mei-Lin feels a momentary emptiness, a missing warmth, before she calls Renshu over to her side. Pei-Wen's children have settled on the deck. The twins sit back to back, leaning against each other for support. Their little brother snuggles against his ma and the baby. All around, conversations are dying down. Mei-Lin and Renshu sit with their backs to the boat's sides, arms wrapped around their belongings. Finally safe, and with a moment of quiet, the enormity of the past week looms over Mei-Lin. Her arm is still tender where Mr. Li had twisted it. Everything is sore and it's hard to sit. Bruises bloom all along her legs and buttocks. A dull pain bites at her exhaustion, keeping her from rest. Ma? Yes? Ma, I'm sorry, Renshu says to the dark. Sorry? Why sorry? She asks back, also looking at the dark. About talking to Mr. Xu. It's all my fault. Mei-Lin closes her eyes and breathes deeply. She waits until she is certain she won't break down when she speaks. Renshu, it's not your fault. She reaches up and puts her arm around him. It hurts to lift her shoulder, but she wants to hold her boy. We are together, she says. We are escaping the fighting. We might even find auntie and uncle in Taiwan. So what makes you so sure this isn't a blessing? Your stories, he starts, and then trails off, as if he doesn't know what to say. How about I tell you a new one? From the scroll? Mei-Lin pauses. It would be too dark to see the scroll right now, so you'll have to use your imagination. She keeps her voice composed, hoping not to reveal how shaken she still is. This is her last story, the one she's been saving to tell when the time was right. Two monks were walking through the countryside on a spring day. She feels Renshu's shoulders relax. Deep in conversation about what it means to become truly enlightened, they come to a roaring river. A peasant woman sitting on the bank called out, Please, dear brothers, will you help me cross? I cannot swim and I'm afraid of the rapids. Without a moment's hesitation, the older monk bent down, lifted the woman and walked into the river. The water swirled and tugged at his ropes, but calm and sure-footed, he brought her to safety on the other side. He set her down on the shore and bowed. Thank you, dear brother, she said, bowing back. Then she gathered a slightly wet bundle and continued on her way. The whole time, the younger monk followed behind without saying a word. They continued walking down the road, now in silence. After some time, the younger monk began to sigh and wrinkle his nose. He became more and more agitated until he could contain his frustration no more.
Brother, how could you do that?
Do what?
Carry that woman. You know it is against the rules of our order to have any contact with females. Why did you break that rule?
The older monk stopped and looked the younger monk straight in the eye. They stood like that for a long time, neither speaking a word. Finally, the older monk said,
Brother, I set that woman down on the other side of the river. Why are you still carrying her?
Mei-Lin takes her arm from Renshu's shoulder and turns to face him. Renshu, let's not carry anything that we've already left behind. Though no longer a boy, his eyes are full of a solemn, simple trust. It has been a decade since the night they fled Changsha. Now, more than ever before, a great unknown awaits. Regardless of what lies ahead, she promises herself, she won't betray this trust. The sea is calm. The ship has turned off its lights to move stealthily, evading the wartime curfew. They fall silent. Soon, Renshu's asleep. Mei-Lin looks back. She sees nothing but dark water. During all these years of disruption, they have still always had China beneath their feet. Now, as the boat sails further away, all that she has ever known, all that great excess and great loss, slips silently beyond the horizon. Waves lick the sides of the ship. Voices murmur on the deck, and the steamer's engines churn. China is gone. Part 3, 1948 to 1960. Chapter 11, Keelung Harbour, Taiwan, December 1948. They stumble into the port's stuffy, overcrowded offices. A queue of people sitting on battered suitcases or rolled-up quilts inches along as each group registers their arrival. When it is their turn, Malin notices the braid on the official's hat is frayed and his buttons have been polished so often that the shiny veneer has flaked off, revealing dull metal underneath.
"State your name, city, and province of origin."
The official doesn't look up, his pen poised to complete his form. Without hesitation, Malin says,
"Zhu, Yuming, and Deng, Jinwei, Wuhan, Hubei Province."
She has been practicing the name since Pei Wen insisted they come with her. "You have nowhere to go. I have no one to help me. Use my sister-in-law and brother-in-law's names. Use their ration cards. We have to help each other out in these hard times. Where will you live otherwise?"
"Identification papers."
Malin hands him the documents from Pei Wen and watches him copy the information. He briefly raises his eyes to ask for her last place of residence. Malin gives the address of Madame Zhu's shikumen. Taking out a soiled handkerchief, he wipes his glistening forehead. He signs and stamps various papers, gathers them up, and hands them all to her. He is explaining something, but Malin is so relieved she can't take anything in. He dismisses them. Renshu picks up her basket and their suitcase, and they exit into the bright, cold air. Outside, people mill around, waiting for friends and relatives. Others look uncertain. Now that they have arrived in Taiwan, what next? A military transport truck with a canvas top rolls into the area, and people start boarding. It soon fills and drives off.
"Malin,"
Pei Wen calls. She and the children have just emerged from the offices. When the next truck arrives, they show their papers to the driver, climb on, and ride into Taipei. It's a small city. There are only a few motor cars running among the pedestrians, bicycles, pedicabs, and rickshaws. Traffic ducks in and out of lanes and down alleys that lead off the main roads. After the dense motion she'd grown accustomed to in Shanghai, Malin welcomes the relative calm. Her eye wanders over the unfamiliar architecture of red and grey bricks. The buildings are shorter, few reaching above two stories. Most people are wearing clothes in styles she's never seen, and Malin can't understand the language. "Japanese?" Pei Wen shakes her head. "No, it's something else." They drive past people walking along the roads, carrying belongings, looking for places to stay. Locals jeer at the truck as it rumbles by. Finally, they pull up at a building that looks like a school. Through an open door, Malin sees it is already overflowing with occupants. A small man in a khaki uniform rushes out, crying, "No room! No room!" and signals for them to drive on. At the city's outskirts, the truck stops again outside a massive, slightly dilapidated warehouse. The building sides are made of corrugated iron. Weeds and yellowed grasses poke up between cracks in the concrete paving. A big man, also in a khaki uniform, comes over, confers with the driver, and then motions for everyone to get off the truck. They stand in a daze, surrounded by their few belongings. The uniformed man pulls the warehouse doors open and calls them inside. It is as dark as a cave. When her eyes adjust, Malin sees the warehouse has been divided into several small makeshift shelters, with thin walls made from bagasse boards that have been precariously nailed together. Each marks a living space for a family. A tarp slung over a rope functions as a door. As they follow the man, they pass some sections with this curtain pulled back. People gather around overturned crates or the occasional glow of a kerosene lamp. It is a tiny village contained inside this big building. At the far end, people wait in a queue to use zinc basins for washing. The man points out a communal water tank where they can get an allotted amount each day. The kitchen is a long counter with small, coal-cake-fired earthen stoves. Outside, in a nearby field, the man shows them the toilet, a simple shack. Inside, there is a place to squat on rough planks set across a deep ditch. The stench is staggering. Flies buzz everywhere. After this tour, each new family is issued a space of 2 ping for living, regardless of the number of family members. Then the man hurries off to attend to some other duty. Once they have set their belongings inside, Mei Lin and Pei Wen send the kids off to collect water. Pei Wen holds the baby and turns a slow circle, letting out a slow sigh as she looks at the stained tarp curtain, the flimsy walls, the concrete floor. "It's only temporary," Mei Lin says.
"We have a roof over our heads and a floor under our feet," Pei Wen adds.
They arrange their blankets into warm beds as best they can. When the children return, they cook some of Pei Wen's dwindling supply of rice. Afterwards, they sit side by side for warmth, still hungry and tired, but glad the sea no longer moves underneath them. Somehow, the afternoon and evening have passed in shuffling and worry, and now night has arrived. The bare bulbs hanging above are turned off, and the weak light they offered disappears. Throughout the warehouse, kerosene lamps flicker, throwing shadows high up on the walls. Mei Lin hears many different accents and dialects. Everyone is from somewhere else. One by one, the lamps blink off and the talk dies down. As they lie in their new shelter, this dank, damp warehouse on an island far from home, the cold from the floor steals through their bedding to settle directly on their skin.
"It's only temporary," Pei Wen says, echoing Mei Lin's earlier words.
There is rustling throughout the warehouse. Do mice scurry among the stores of grain? Wisps of conversation and cigarette smoke drift in from outside. Mei Lin stares up into the high rafters of the warehouse. It is like looking at a night sky in which all the stars have been extinguished. Throughout the first winter, they bargain in the market every day for old vegetables. They look for scraps of bamboo and discarded wood for small fires. Because Pei Wen's husband is in the military, the government gives them rations of flour, oil, salt. It is not enough, but it is something. Other families in the warehouse help them enroll the kids in the schools for military families, point them to the native place associations that have formed. Slowly, they begin to piece together a life. One day, Mei Lin finds a newspaper, Zhongyang Ribao, left behind in the market. The front page shouts slogans about the Generalissimo, but Mei Lin turns it over, and on the back, she notices the missing persons classifieds. People are looking for relatives last seen on the mainland. Some ads give the name and contact details for the seeker. Others name and describe lost family members. For the next hour, she stands in the cold air and reads them. Each tiny box of text tells a story of huge loss and stubborn hope. Maybe Longwei, if he's here, will have placed one for her and Renshu. At the end of the last column, she sighs. No luck. As winter turns to spring, whenever she can, Mei Lin gets a newspaper and reads every single missing person's advert. She even places a few herself, naming Longwei, Wenling, and Li Fen. Where there's a chance, she must try, but she never hears back. By March, the warehouse is full. trucks filled with new arrivals are sent somewhere else. Although winds shake the walls and hailstorms batter the roof, the only things that fall on their heads are raindrops from leaks and cracks, not shrapnel. A buzz overhead signifies mosquitoes, not airplanes. In April, headlines proclaim that the Communist Army has jumped the Yangtze and taken Nanjing. When Shanghai falls in May, the classified sections swell, but there is no sign of Longwei. In October, Mao Zedong proclaims the establishment of the People's Republic of China. When Chiang Kai-shek retreats to Taipei in December with the last of his troops, declaring that the Republic of China will stage its recovery of the mainland from Taiwan, Mei Lin stops reading the newspapers. She's too tired these days. She's been spending the evening sewing. Though the weak light inside the warehouse strains her eyes, she embroiders tiny bats and peonies on purses she then sells in the market. Despite everything, Mei Lin insists on adding brightness and beauty. It's been nearly a year since they arrived in Taiwan. In early winter, Pei Wen's husband, Yu Ping, sends news that a spot has finally opened up for them at a new Harmony Zhuanchun, a military family's village. They leave the warehouse for a tiny two-room house. One room is for Pei Wen and her kids. The other is for Mei Lin and Ren Shu, and the food and small stove they bought on the black market. Though cramped, their new place has solid walls. It is somewhere to return to at the end of the day. It can become a home. Taipei, Taiwan, September 1950. At the Zhuanchun, Mei Lin's friendship with Pei Wen strengthens. They continue to share the work of looking after the children, cooking and shopping. She is grateful the kids have school. The government rations of food and basic supplies continue. They are reaching towards stability. Of course, military patrols are everywhere. That's to be expected. Everyone is preparing for when, in a few years' time, the KMT will retake the motherland from the communist bandits. There are American sailors, too, in Taipei. Since the outbreak of the Korean War, the US Navy's 7th Fleet has been patrolling the strait. In the evenings and afternoons, when it's too hot to stay inside, people drag rattan chairs into the narrow alleyways between houses, chatting and reminiscing as they try to cool down. The atmosphere overflows with stories and songs in different dialects. Often, families prepare dishes from their hometowns to share. When people speak of returning to the motherland, Mei Lin grows quiet. They long for families, homes, friends, beloved places. But when Mei Lin looks back, she sees nothing but loss, no one but ghosts. Kids run wild through the compound, in and out of each other's houses, trading toys, food and swear words. Gossip travels along the alleyways and down the lanes faster than those gossip about can get home to set the story straight. Mei Lin feels like she's part of a big family. Still, one must be careful. Ears and eyes are everywhere. More often than not, when Mei Lin looks out the window, someone else looks back in at her. Sounds, smells, and conversations pass straight through the thin walls. Everyone heard Mr. Chen the night he stumbled down the alleyways, drunkenly cursing the KMT, cursing the Generalissimo, and even denouncing Madame Chang. No one was surprised when the garrison command dragged him away 2 days later. In Mei Lin's view, as long as you don't criticize the government or make anyone angry or jealous enough to falsely accuse you, it's possible to grow, even flourish here. Besides, after the betrayals in Shanghai, Mei Lin has lost all appetite for politics. Instead, she focuses on Ren Shu. She tries to find something joyful in each day, making food that the children like, selling handicrafts in the market, or bargaining for fresh vegetables, building a life on small but certain pleasures. Today is Ren Shu's first day at Jianghuo High School. His new shoes feel stiff. It's hard to concentrate because he keeps tracing his fingers along the clean, sharp cuffs of his shirt and sneaking glances at the seams pressed into his trouser legs. Itchy as it is, he is proud to wear this new uniform. Last year, at middle school, he was glad to sit at a desk for lessons without the constant fear of air raids or emergency evacuations. He did well, and at the end of the year, his teachers encouraged him to go to Jianguo. Now, the teacher has put up a mathematics problem using terms and symbols that Renshu doesn't know. All his classmates are busy making calculations and drawing graphs. Renshu stares at the board. He is used to finishing top in his lessons. However fragmented his learning in Chongqing, Shanghai, or even last year at the middle school, he has always shone. But now, he doesn't even understand the questions, let alone know the answers. He goes mute with shame. That afternoon, back at the Zhuanchun, his ma greets him with a hopeful look. How was it?
Good.
He fiddles with the clasp on his bag. That's it? Nothing else? He looks at her and shakes his head. He says he needs to study. It's quiet in the house. Peiwen and the baby must be out. Thankfully, the kids aren't home yet. He sits on the settee and takes out some paper and a small, worn textbook. He pulls an upturned crate towards him and places his paper and pencil on top. Thumbing through to the page the teacher assigned, he balances the book on his leg, keeping it open with his elbow. With one hand, he holds the crate steady, and with the other, he works out the maths. He can hear his ma in the other room, cutting something on the chopping board. She comes in with a plate of watermelon slices. He says he's not hungry, and looks at his paper again. Somewhere, the calculation has gone wrong, and he can't find his mistake. She sets the plate down and sits next to him, accidentally knocking the book to the floor. She picks it up and hands it back. He flips the pages until he finds his place again and creases the spine to make the book stay open. What is it, Renshu? What's wrong? Renshu jams his pencil into the textbook and closes the cover. I'm so far behind everyone else. I'll never catch up, and... He looks up at the door, his voice cracking in frustration. In 2 minutes, Peiwen's kids will come home. When will I study? How can I learn? At night, there's not enough light. In the day, there's too much noise. And there's no space in this house. He scowls and kicks the crate, knocking over the watermelon slices. He starts to pick them up, but then, exasperated, he walks out, slamming the wooden door. Meilin hasn't seen Renshu so angry in a long time. For weeks, he had been looking forward to starting at Jianguo. How frustrating it must be to begin at last, only to feel like he's falling short. Meilin looks around the small, cramped space. What can she do? The voices of Peiwen's kids echo down the alley. Meilin quickly tidies the room and puts Renshu's bag away. She has just put fresh melon slices on the plate when the family bursts through the door. The twins are arguing, and their brother is whining. When they see the melon, all three drop their school bags to grab slices. They start eating right away, hardly stopping to say hello before heading back outside, spitting the seeds out in the dirt road. Later that week, when Renshu arrives home, his ma ushers him into the back room. Here, she says, showing him a small table she has made by placing a long bagasse board across the top of two wooden crates. She demonstrates how he can sit on the floor and spread his work out. I will take care of the kids after school. The girls can go to the market together, and Huifei can help me. Renshu kneels and runs his hand along the surface of the board. A desk, a place to sit, time to study. She says she traded a pair of embroidered slippers and a mended silk jacket he had outgrown for the crates and board. She shows him how she has tucked the bedding inside the crates so the room feels both tidier and more spacious, even though it holds more things. I will make you proud, Ma. I will do my best. His eyes fill, but he is too old to cry. He already make me proud. Look, she points. Outside, a cock struts by, waggling its wattle. A rooster! A good sight, isn't it? He laughs. Yes, practice your learning here. Your characters, your calculations. Study hard. Ma, where is it? Where is what? The scroll. Where is it? It's a question that's been on his mind for a long time. He hasn't seen it since before they came to Taiwan. The first time Renchu asked Mei Lin about the scroll was when they were living in the warehouse. She had said that taking it out would attract unwanted attention. Though he promised he'd be very quiet, very gentle, she'd refused. After that, he asked a few more times, but she always said no. Once they'd moved to the Zhuanchun and had a room of their own, he asked again. His ma frowned, shook her head, and carried on with her sewing. In that moment, he saw how much his question had troubled her. Since then, something has held him back from asking. But today, the rooster has reminded them both of the scroll, so he thought it would be okay. A shadow passes over Mei Lin's face and she lowers her eyes. Her expression tells him the answer, even though she doesn't speak. He suspected it might be gone, but her tiny gesture feels like a massive blow. He didn't realize how much he had hoped otherwise. What happened? I sold it. Her voice is hoarse. Sold it? Renchu's voice rises with anger. How could you? It was our only connection to Ba. Why did you sell it? He is fuming, surprised by his own fury. Stricken, his ma takes in a sharp breath. I had no other choice. We had to get out of Shanghai. Tears are rolling down her cheeks. He hasn't seen her cry like this in a long time. He tries to tamp down his dismay, angry at himself now for upsetting her. Ma, I'm sorry. It's just that we loved it so much. If all this had it. She's crying, and he doesn't know what to do. This was such a happy moment, and he's ruined it. What happened in Shanghai? Those last days were so chaotic. Finally, she recovers enough to speak. It was only an object, Renchu. Maybe it was never ours to keep. The important thing is that we have its stories. The front door bangs open, and the noise of Pei Wen's children fills the house. She wipes her eyes, stands, and nudges his bag towards him. Study now. Mei Lin's gift of time and space is a sanctuary for Renchu. For the first time, he can concentrate fully. He can study without needing to keep one ear tuned to the outside world, ready to relocate at a moment's notice. He falls in love with the elegance of equations, the properties of motion. He is amazed by how, given an object's initial conditions, he can predict where and when it might arrive elsewhere. There is an inarguable reliability in maths, in physics. Renchu comes to believe that, if he studies enough, anything might make sense. There is a comfort, too, in the realization that nothing can take his learning away. Unlike land, gold, treasures, food, or even people, once he understands something, it is his to keep forever. Taipei, Taiwan, May 1955. It has been a good day for Mei Lin. In the market, Luo was celebrating his grandson's birth, so he threw in an extra bundle of snow peas. Since the PRC's bombardment of the Kinmen and Dacheng Islands last autumn, even more Americans are stationed in Taipei. Missing their sweethearts and wives, they've bought all Mei Lin's embroidered silk purses. She never asks who the treasures are for. A bit of discretion makes her wares sell quickly, a lesson that some sellers with quick tongues have yet to learn. Mei Lin walks home with a full basket. Cabbages, carrots, onions, mangoes, a pineapple, and the snow peas. All this, and she still has some new Taiwan dollars folded in her purse. A group of schoolboys works its way down the street like a khaki-coloured wave, searching for snacks and comics after school. The youngest are the loudest, with satchels slung over their shoulders, untidy hair, shirts untucked, lunch pails light and swinging. She keeps an eye out for Renshu among the older groups, moving with lower voices and longer strides, arms laden with extra books that won't fit in their bags. There he is. Laughing with his friends, he looks happy. There is a certain joy that arises when Mei Lin glimpses everyday contentment in her boy. Given all that they've been through, these small moments of ease feel like big treasures. He catches her eye and nods, says goodbye to his friends and heads over. A good day? He eyes her overflowing basket and takes it from her, shifting his bag to the other shoulder. Yes, I sold out. She holds up her bulging purse. And you? He nods. Teacher Liang has confirmed our places for the joint college entrance exams at the end of summer. There's so much to study. And he pats his bag, bursting with papers and borrowed books. She smiles up at him. Entering the Zhuanchun, they turn down a narrow alleyway, flanked on either side with simple one-story houses connected in long rows. At one end, workmen are repairing and rebuilding the corrugated tin and fiberglass walls. Every year, these houses are patched and mended to last just a little longer. Every year, the government says they'll be victorious in retaking the motherland. But instead, every year, typhoons blow down more walls. Mei Lin hopes their current house will last another season. The communal toilet block is not too crowded, so Renshu hands Mei Lin her basket and ducks in. Mei Lin carries on. Vendors on bicycles wobble down the street, hawking snacks. From open doors and windows, people chat with neighbours. Closer to Pei Wen's, she passes women lifting loads of washing from big willow baskets. They wring out the shirts, trousers and underclothes and hang them along bamboo poles to dry. Among the clothes are children's shorts, sporting the Republic of China flag, hand in hand with the USA stars and stripes sewn from the flour sacks given in aid by the US government. Some women also hang up US soldiers' uniforms to dry. Good money can be made by washing the troops' laundry. As soon as Mei Lin opens the door, she senses something has changed. In the corner stands a new column of suitcases, bags and other luggage. She hears unfamiliar voices. Blinking away the brightness of the afternoon, she sees the outlines of three people crowded on the bamboo settee. Their backs are turned to her, and they speak with a fourth person, who is sitting on a crate turned on its end. He wears the uniform of a middle-ranking KMT officer, and in his face, Mei Lin sees the lines of Pei Wen's eldest boy. Hello? They turn and fall quiet. The man on the crate calls, Pei Wen! Pei Wen comes through the bamboo curtain, drying her wet hands on her apron. Her expression is a mixture of joy and nervousness. Mei Lin, Mei Lin, such wonderful news. My family are here. This is my husband, Zhu Yuping. The man on the crate scowls. Slightly flustered, Pei Wen continues. And this is my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law, Zhu Yuming, and her husband, Deng Jinwei. Zhu Yuming and Deng Jinwei. The names on the ration cards Mei Lin and Renshu have been using. Yuming turns around. She is younger than Pei Wen, expecting a baby, and wears a look of travel weariness that Mei Lin has almost forgotten. Jinwei, slouched in his seat, glances at Mei Lin with watery eyes and mumbles a greeting. At the end of the settee sits the silver-haired matriarch with her mouth drawn in, holding her lips tightly over her teeth. Competing emotions rise in Mei Lin. Joy for Pei Wen, sadness for her own lost family, worry about what this means. She masks her ambivalence with a smile and holds out her hands in welcome.
I have extra vegetables to celebrate, she stammers, picking up her basket.
Come, Peiwen motions to her. Help me prepare.
I will tell you all.
She pulls Mei Lin towards the kitchen. Yuming, the tea is almost ready. You bring it in and sit with the others. Big Sister and I will finish the cooking. By the time Yuming has poured tea, Renshu has entered. After another round of introduction, Renshu joins them in the kitchen.
Ma?
It's okay, Renshu. Go get the kids from school.
Ma, are they staying?
He whispers.
Of course. They are Peiwen's family.
She sees him considering the implications this will have for the modest house that has sheltered them for the past 5 years. Mei Lin and Renshu have grown used to sleeping on the floor in the back room after all the dishes have been tidied, while Peiwen and her children squeeze across the front room in 5 sets of blankets and pillows they roll out each night and pack away each morning. Now they will add 4 more, with a baby soon to come. She pushes him towards the door.
Go get the kids for me today. Take them to the market.
He looks doubtful, but she takes a note from her purse and presses it in his hands. Here, buy some melon seeds or sugarcane stalks to celebrate the arrival of family. She watches him disappear down the alley. When she turns back to Peiwen, her friend's eyes are filled with tears.
Peiwen, you must be so happy. This is great good fortune.
Of course. I thought I'd never see any of them again. My husband found them all. And he got Deng Jinwei transferred here too. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes, it's wonderful, Mei Lin agrees.
Someone must have told them how to find me. I am so happy.
Peiwen's voice peters out as her eyes rest on Mei Lin and Renshu's rolled up quilts and blankets. Peiwen kneels to open a tub of rice and measures out cupfuls to pick through and rinse. The grains sound like rain as they slide over one another, out of the cup and into the enamel basin. Mei Lin looks out the back door to where Renshu and the children collected bamboo and scraps of wire to make a fence. Could they fashion a roof too? Strengthen the fence into walls and make a new room back there? Many other families have been building extensions. They could too. She tries to imagine how to accommodate more people. How will they all eat? Where will they get more bowls, blankets, bedding? It's too hard to hold all these thoughts at once. She peers into the kettle. It is almost empty. She picks it up and heads out for more water. Returning to the house, she pauses outside the back door. Peiwen and Yuping are arguing.
They are like family. We help each other. That's how it works here.
But we are family, he hisses back. Besides, we cannot risk having 2 people using the same ration cards. You have already given them more than enough.
But where would they go? Besides, Mei Lin has shared her earnings. Renshu has helped with the kids. We wouldn't have survived without them.
You wouldn't have survived without me. It is because I serve that we have all this.
There is a clatter, as if something has been shoved across the counter.
1 week. Then they go. This rice is for family, not like family.
The bamboo curtains slide and swish. Mei Lin hears Peiwen draw in a sharp, ragged sob.
Again.
They will have to move again.
Where? They don't know anyone outside the Zhuanchun. Mei Lin swallows back her tears and pushes away her questions. It's still a happy day, a day of reunion. When Mei Lin peeks around the corner, she sees her friend's eyes are red and she is picking up bowls from the floor, rubbing at the chipped edges.
I'm sorry, Peiwen whispers. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Mei Lin puts the kettle down and embraces her friend. We'll find our way.
Hey, look at what Luo had today.
She leans over to her basket, pulling out the pineapple.
Let's celebrate the return of family.
Peiwen wipes her eyes and picks up the kettle. She pours the water carefully over the rice grains, then sets the bowl aside to soak. Meilin takes the vegetables from her basket, peels the onion, inspects the cabbage leaves. The kitchen soon fills with the sound of chopping and the clink of bowls and dishes being stacked back into order. Chapter 12. Taipei, Taiwan, June 1955. Meilin leans against an arcade column outside the newsagents with a copy of the Zhongyang Ribao. She and Renshu need a new home. Soon. She turns past the headlines with their empty promises about reclaiming the motherland, thinking about how this temporary sojourn in Taiwan has become their most permanent home since Changsha. She skims the classifieds and stops at the Help Wanted section. She remembers overhearing two women complaining about the lack of good help during a recent festival at the Hubei Native Place Association. Meilin had stood quietly to the side as they gossiped about how another family had brought their nannies, maids and cooks from Wuhan, and that was why their children were doing better at school. One of the women lamented that she could only get local girls to help her. "Those maids don't know how to prepare braised eggplant properly, and they teach the children nasty habits. They don't even speak Mandarin." The other added that, though she had expected the Benzhengren girl to get better deals in the market, she suspected their servant just bought second-rate produce from her cousins and kept the extra money. "This island is such a nightmare. When are we going home?" On and on the two women had complained. At the time, Meilin had thought to herself that if things were going well and they had no complaints, the women wouldn't have had such a nice time at the celebration after all. Meilin studies their advertisements. Maids from Hunan wanted. Looking for mainlander babysitters. Domestic help required. Sichuan natives preferred. There are so many. Surely she can find a job. She carefully tears out the page and puts it in her pocket. She leaves the rest of the newspaper behind. Perhaps it will bring good luck to someone else. The next day, Meilin brushes her hair neatly and puts on the summer dress that she made from a pretty yellow and green floral print. The dress is simple, but it fits just right and she loves it. She wants to wear something special instead of her usual tunic over trousers. On the newspaper clipping, she has circled four adverts. Three are clustered in the Da'an district, and one is on Qidong Street in Zhongzheng. All are good locations for Renshu School. She starts in Da'an. At the first house, no one answers. At the second, when the door opens and she holds up the paper, the person inside says, "Too late, already filled." She makes her way to the third house. Here, the woman seems interested, and Meilin is hopeful. But when the woman explains that Meilin would have to live somewhere else, the conversation ends. She heads towards Qidong Street. It's hot. Her forehead feels sticky, and her dress has become rumpled from all the walking. She'll try one more, and then, if she's unlucky, maybe Peiwen can let them stay for just a few more days. All the houses on Qidong Street are in the Japanese style. Meilin walks slowly past each one, admiring delicate flower gardens, until she stops at the number she noted. She straightens her dress, brushes off the dust from the day, and holds her head high. She unlatches the gate and follows a pebbled path with stone lanterns up to the door. A willow tree shades the porch, and a small acer grows beneath. She hears running water. Meilin rings the bell, admiring an octagonal window with partially frosted glass. When the door opens, she is greeted by an older woman, soft-featured and stout, with wet hands and a kerchief tying back her hair. Her kind eyes and big smile put Meilin at ease. When Meilin explains she has come about the advert, the woman nods, then ushers her into a small entry hall and points at a pair of slippers. "Please wait while I tell Madame Huang," she says, disappearing behind a sliding wooden paper door. Malin can smell meat and fresh rice cooking. She exchanges her shoes for the slippers and surveys her surroundings. A landscape painting of cloudy mountains graces the entry. Black ink on yellowed silk. Tang Dynasty, most likely. In front of her, a Huanghua Li table boasts an incense burner, a carved trinket box, and an intricate sandalwood fan. She longs to pick up the fan and hold it to her nose, inhaling the scent. Seeing such treasures rattles Mei Lin, summoning too many memories. She stifles her urge to sob and looks down. The sliding door opens and the older woman motions Mei Lin down a long wooden corridor that creaks as they walk. On one side, full-length windows open to a stone garden. On the other, white sliding walls etched in black conceal the rooms behind. At the corridor's end, the woman slides open another door and gestures for Mei Lin to enter. The main part of the room is sunken lower than the walkways. Mei Lin notices that the tatami mats on the floor are concealed by a soft, luxurious rug. On a sofa, with red and yellow silk cushions and fine upholstery, lounges Madame Huang. Her mixture of elegance and disdain reminds Mei Lin of Wenling. There is a similarity in Madame's manner as she regards Mei Lin, her expression both lazy and critical. When she speaks, Madame's voice is sharp, with a strong Sichuan accent, firing off questions that only a Sichuanese could understand and answer. Mei Lin is grateful for the time she spent learning the dialect while in Chongqing. In fact, part of her delights to hear Madame using the familiar colloquialisms. Mei Lin suspects Madame's manner is mostly performance, testing her mettle. Mei Lin holds her composure and answers back. Yes, I can make that dish. Yes, I know where to get those vegetables. Yes, I can launder and mend. Yes, I can sew. At this, Mei Lin holds up her finest embroidered purse. Madame Huang's eyes shine. Well, says Madame, I suppose we'll try you out. You'll be better than those locals. Mei Lin holds up her hand. What is it? Madame is irritable. I have a son. He's a good boy, studies hard. He's quiet and polite. Can he stay here too? Curiosity piqued, Madame's lips tighten. A boy? He'll have to help in the gardens. What did you say his name was? Dao Renshu. Renshu, Mei Lin whispers. Renshu, Madame says thoughtfully. How old? He's nearly finished at Tianguo High School. He's studying for the joint entrance exams. Very well, then. Madame nods her assent. Now speak with Cook Chin to find out what she needs from the market. He must clean and press the washing so I have my best cheap house ready for the dinner at General Fan's on Tuesday. And can you adjust these curtains? I don't like the way they fall. They're too long and make the room feel heavy. She gets up and pulls open a bureau drawer, taking out a bolt of blue-green silk. You must do something with this. I have been saving it since we arrived. My last maid was hopeless. Wouldn't trust her with my worst silk, let alone my best. Just as Madame exhausts her list, the older woman returns with a tea tray. Mei Lin bows and backs out of the room. While Mei Lin changes back into her street shoes, the older woman sidles up and puts her arm around Mei Lin. Call me Auntie Chin. Madame is thrilled you're here. Never mind her brashness, she means well. The general mostly keeps to himself and his work. Stick with me, and you'll be fine. Mei Lin heads back to the Zhuanchun, tired but relieved. It takes longer for Mei Lin to say goodbye to Pei Wen than it does to pack their few belongings. She leaves behind anything that Pei Wen could use and takes only their clothes, Renshu's books, and her sewing basket. Visit us often, Pei Wen says, grasping Mei Lin's hand, not wanting to let go. You are always welcome here, she adds, even though both know that is no longer true. Thank you, Malin says, and squeezes Peiwen's hand. At the Huangs, Auntie Chin shows Malin a small room to the side of the kitchen that is for her and Renshu. Three tatami mats cover the floor. A large window faces the street, and its windowsill is low and wide. In the corner is a small table with a lamp and an electric fan. Malin turns both on. The air in the room stirs softly, the light inviting. Malin arranges Renshu's books on the windowsill. On the table, she puts his inkstone, his brushes, paper, and a new inkstick. She reflects on how quickly, once again, their circumstances have changed. While she doesn't know Madame and the General yet, she feels like she is on familiar ground. The scents from the kitchen, the banter between Auntie Chin and the gardener, and Madame's concerns remind her of the Dao family compound. When he sees the room, Renshu's face breaks into a broad smile. "Here," Malin says, gesturing to where a pair of thick, soft coverlets lie. "Here are beds that will not move in the night. Here is a desk that stays standing all day. Here are walls that do not sway with the winds or let the rain and cold leak through."
"Is it just temporary?"
he asks. "I don't know, but it is just for us." The room at the Huangs becomes a retreat for Renshu in the final months leading up to the joint college and university's entrance examination. While Malin spends her days learning her new job, Renshu studies in that quiet space, its fan cooling the air and its shades drawn against bright sunlight and distraction. On the day of the exam, he finds great satisfaction in being able to answer every question. When he gives in his paper, he knows he has done his absolute best. His results are good. He receives an offer to study engineering at National Taiwan University. He rushes home to tell his ma. Breathless and bursting with joy, he picks her up and whirls her in a circle. Once he puts her down, she exclaims, "I'm so proud. It's what you said you wanted on the day of the Lantern Festival in Shanghai. You have made it happen. Do you remember?" Renshu nods and notices his ma is teary. "Ma, are you sad?"
"No, yes, of course not. It's just,"
and she wipes her eye,
"I wish your father could know. I wish my father could know."
Renshu hugs her gently. "Me too," he says. "When I think of all that we've gone through, during all those years when I scarcely dared to imagine the future, it's..." She sniffs and shakes her head. Whatever it is she wants to say, she can't seem to summon the words. Finally, she just pulls him close and embraces him again. Later that night, when she reflects on his ma's reaction, it dawns on him that when he goes to university, they will be apart for the first time in his life. Renshu is granted a small scholarship and work-study job at the library to help with his fees. He finds housing in a men's dormitory near the campus, sharing a room with three other students. The NTU campus lies southeast of Zhongzheng, surrounded by rice paddies and narrow footpaths away from the commotion of the city. Even though it's less than an hour's walk from Qidong Street, it's a different world. On the first night in the dormitory, Renshu is restless. It is strange not to hear his ma's soft breathing. He wrestles with his blanket, hoping he isn't disturbing his roommates. From the bunks across the room, alternating snores indicate Pao Dafei and Liu Zhaohui are asleep. Above him is Li Houtan. Pao, who Renshu recognizes from Jianguo, is studying physics. Li and Liu, like Renshu, are engineering students. They knew each other before coming to university, both having lived at the same Zhuanchun in Hsinchu. Renshu sighs and flips his pillow over.
"Are you asleep?"
whispers Li Houtan.
"Not really," Renshu whispers back.
"Me neither. It's just, I guess, odd to fall asleep,"
Renshu pauses, not wanting to say he misses his ma. In a new place, he finishes. I know what you mean. I'm used to my sibling sleeping right next to me.
Where are you from, Li Hotan? I mean, before Xinchu.
We were in Kunming.
And before that?
Our hometown was near Wuhan.
And you?
We are from Changsha.
We went to Chongqing, then Shanghai, then here.
Hmm,
Li says, acknowledging so much with a murmur.
Renshu yawns. Dao Renshu.
Yes?
Pao says there's a good noodle vendor by the main university gate in the early evenings. Let's go tomorrow after classes.
Renshu smiles in the dark. I'd like that. On the first day of lectures, Renshu joins a flock of students walking along the Royal Palm Boulevard. Everyone wears freshly pressed white shirts, khaki trousers or knee-length skirts, and polished shoes to start the year. He is amazed to find himself surrounded by so many young people, all hoping to rebuild the Republic. By the end of the day, his head spins, and he's glad when it's time for the evening meal with Pao and Li. They, too, have found the day both overwhelming and inspiring. Renshu relaxes as he realizes he's not alone in feeling intimidated by this new life. The talk ranges from imitating the mannerisms of a mathematics professor, to speculating which courses will be the most difficult, to eyeing pretty girls at a table nearby. After many bowls of noodles and a little too much to drink, they eventually stumble home, singing songs. As the year progresses, Renshu thrives. He is fascinated with physics, with engineering and problem-solving. And like most everyone else, he continues with his English language classes. Given the ever-strengthening links between the US and the Republic of China, knowing the language will better his chances for just about everything. Li Hotan and Pao Dafei become great friends. They all have memories of the War of Aggression and the Civil War. Even though they don't discuss them much, this shared past bonds them. Each knows how lucky they are to be here. Pao, despite his solemn demeanour, has a wicked sense of humour. His family came to Taiwan from Guilin shortly after retrocession, so he has known Taipei the longest. When they all go out, Pao does most of the talking. He has a knack for knowing where the best food vendors will show up. Li Hotan, on the other hand, is personable and handsome. Girls are always bringing him dumplings or asking for help with their assignments. Together with Pao and Li, Renshu spends long evenings studying, taking breaks for noodles or shaved ice from the stands along the Liu Gongjun canals. Sometimes, they watch American movies at the cinema and flirt with female students. While Renshu is too shy to say much to the girls, he is delighted to be in their company. Most weekends, he visits the Qidong Street house. His ma and Auntie Chin are always happy to see him, and even Madame and General Huang occasionally say hello. But each time, as his visit draws to an end, he feels the pull back to his new life at the university. Once Renshu starts university, Mei Lin reminds herself that he's only a short distance away. This is the future they both wanted. She is proud of his achievements, proud that he will be a scholar. But she didn't expect this sideswipe of sorrow she feels now that he has started to make a life on his own. As much as she tries to brush it away, she can't dismiss the feeling that their bond, which has held them together through fires, bombings and betrayals, is starting to weaken. Mei Lin pushes aside what she can't change, and instead focuses on her work. As the months pass, Mei Lin notices that the Huangs have all the luxuries one could want. Teas, wines, brandies, tobacco, cosmetics, silk. Although she wonders where these luxuries come from, Mei Lin knows better than to ask. The only inquiry she makes are what dishes Madame and the General would like to eat, which flowers she should put in the porcelain vases, and when Madame needs her cheap house ready for glamorous soirees. However replete they are with luxuries, though, they are running low on rice.
The Huangs do not want to rely on the US wheat subsidies like common military folk. The last maid, a local girl, had procured a large amount of rice. In fact, it was because she boasted that she could get rice that Madame Huang had hired her. As the stockpile shrinks, Mei Lin's worry increases. Will they dismiss her if she cannot replenish the supply? She doesn't want to find out. Auntie Chin says she's heard that Mr. Tsai in the market sells rice, but it's overpriced and full of grit, and sometimes even bugs. Somehow, the Bensheng-ren girl got good rice from him, but Auntie Chin doesn't know how she did it. Those Bensheng-ren. Auntie Chin shakes her head in disgust. They should be grateful we saved them from the Japanese. Instead, they cheat us and refuse to speak properly. Mei Lin thanks Auntie Chin.